This is Kaz Bielan, and you're watching or listening to Casual Conversations, where we explore topics that are important to our world by people who can actually help us deal with those topics in our world. Today, our very special guest, he's back for a third time, is Terry Blackwell, and he is an LBCBA and an SAS in New York. So once again, as they say, state your credentials, Mr. Blackwell.
Sure. The LBCBA is a licensed board certified behavior analyst, and the SAS is the school administrative supervisor for New York Permanent, which is actually a school principal license in the state of New York.
Awesome. And our topic today is, what is ABA and why is it important to educators now more than ever? And educators, by that I mean educators who are professional educators, but also educators who do homeschooling of kids. And I think we're primarily talking about special needs kids, but also kids who are out there in the system as well. There's some behavior issues with that as well. So tell us what it's applied behavioral analysis. That's ABA. So explain to the people what that is again.
Sure. It's actually applied behavior analysis.
Behavior.
I used to say that myself all the time. applied behavior analysis is the science of the future probability of human behavior, which is a fancy way of saying it is the science of human behavior. If you've ever heard of Pavlov's dog in the early 1900s, that was the science that looked at things that happened before a behavior that could alter the behavior. If you've ever heard of B.F. Skinner from up at Harvard, he looked at something that happened after the behavior, consequences that occurred after the behavior, and how that impacts behavior. If you put it all together, you have that these two scientists didn't invent behavior analysis. They more or less uncovered how behavior operates with human beings as well as with other species. If the Pavlov example was, you know, the dog salivates when he sees the meat because he's hungry, and Pavlov paired that up with a bell, and then ultimately the bell acquires the properties of the meat so that when the dog hears the bell, he begins to salivate. Those were things that happened before the behavior of eating. Skinner, on the other hand, was fascinated with what happens, what operates on the behavior, and he found that things that occur after a behavior have a likelihood of either increasing, which we call reinforcement, or decreasing the future probability of behavior, which very often is confused with aversives, but it's called punishment. If it decreases the future likelihood, the behavior is on a punishment track. I thought that this conversation today was extremely important because I'm seeing a large number of reports and videos of severe problem behavior or problem behavior that people are encountering, and those people are typically either instructors, school personnel, sometimes teachers' aides, or they may very well be some of the parents that have decided over a million kids went into homeschooling during the pandemic, and the indication is that they're not coming back. So, you know, ABA, applied behavior analysis, and the ability to shape behavior becomes critically important. Because how can you educate a child who's not attending to instruction? And that's why I thought that it would be very important to have this conversation together, because teachers in their training, I have taught at Seton Hall University and have had conversations with the individuals who chair those teaching departments that create the teachers, or some of the teachers in New Jersey. And their plate is very full. They don't really have the expertise or the time to instruct teachers on how to reduce problem behavior through scientific methods such as ABA.
Yeah, well, before I go any further, that's great information, Terry. I just remind people that this is a video podcast and audio podcast. And we do the two prior ones we did one on special education topic available options. And then we also did one on changing the world one child at a time, which is the original one. And the links of those will be provided below wherever you're listening or you're watching on YouTube, on LinkedIn, on Facebook, wherever else. But you can watch those and listen to them. And I don't know if it's more important that they see us, Terry, or they listen to us. What do you think? I mean, they can listen to us and look away if they don't like the way we look, but I think we look great.
Right. I think it depends upon a person's preference as to how they process their information. I tend to be auditory, so I'm fine if it's a podcast, but visual, here we are live and in person.
Can you give the people who are watching, let's say who haven't taken advantage of either professional assistance or just on their own, they're homeschooling, first-time parents who are dealing with the special needs for their children, like some things that they should think about.
Sure.
You know, or they can do in their home in the early stages, you know, before they actually go seek more additional help. Is there something, you know, what they know, they realize, or they find out, you know, the situation? Well, what can they do first?
Well, to start with, that I think applied behavior analysis doesn't simply apply to special needs kids, whether that's at homeschooling or whether that's in a public or parochial school. It applies to all children, right? Because the shaping of the future probability of behavior applies to all of us. And I use the example, perhaps at home, and I'll switch off to a home task. If a parent goes and they say to their 7, 8, 9-year-old child, all right, before you go out, I want you to clean up your room. And the child goes back into the room, closes the door, and the parent comes back a half an hour later, and there's been no movement, the bed's not made, things are still on the floor. And the parent says, again, I want you to clean up your room. But again, nothing happens. A half an hour later, they come and they shake their heads and they say, you know, we'll get to it later. Come on, we're going out now. Unfortunately, what has just been taught to that child is that when a parent makes a demand, there's no follow through. And that child then learns that if not just in that circumstance of the room, but generalizes to other areas, well, you know, when a demand is put in place, it doesn't necessarily have a follow up to it. As opposed to the parent who is dealing with that child who says, I'm not cleaning up my room, and or doesn't clean up the room, and the parent actually stays there and puts a demand on and perhaps even helps with hand-on-hand instruction and helps them to pick up an item and put it away and then stops the interaction. So in that instance, if I always ask myself, who has who under instructional control at the end of the interaction? So back to your question about homeschooling and in-class supports for changing behavior. If the end of the interaction is such that the student's behavior controlled you, then you're losing and you're likely to see further increases of that behavior. I use high school example of the class clown, right? I don't know about you, but I went to a rather large high school and inevitably there would be a kid who wanted to get everybody's attention and he was the class clown and he'd crack everybody up. And eventually the poor substitute teacher would get frustrated. You know, Jimmy, that's it. Go down to the principal's office. And the last thing that he would do before he was walking out of the class was what? Slam the door. Well, if he slams the door at that instant, what happens? The class all cracks up, right? They break up. And the question again of who had who under instructional control at the end of that interaction comes up. Mm-hmm. How different would that be if the instant before he slams the door and the teacher knows he's going to, she says, close the door? Well, now he does. He does the same exact behavior, but the class doesn't break up. Why? Because the teacher had him under instructional control at the end of the interaction. And that therefore dictates the future probability of his behavior going forward with that individual.
But what happens then, you know, when the other kids in class who experience this misbehavior and they see the kid gets away with it? So maybe some other kids, you know, and I'm talking about primarily, you know, mainstream school kids, you mm-hmm. know, see that and they go, hey, I thought about doing something like that. It got a laugh, you know, other person that they want them to like them or something. So they smiled and laughed at this thing. So maybe they can do the same thing and get more attention because they don't get the attention they want or they need. So how do you help with that situation? I mean, let's say the kid got away with it, but what's the next move? Or kids, let's say, who are older, who are able to get away with that, but suddenly they're getting into high school level, let's say, and they're thinking, oh, middle school was fun. I was the king or queen of the school, you know, everybody adored me. And then suddenly they go into the little fish suddenly is in the big pond again. They realize that there are other big fish who already have that throne. So how do you deal with that?
So the world of applied behavior analysis, or ABA, deals with what are called functions of behavior. And when there are people in the room, there are really only two functions. And this is all evidence-based, based upon more than 50 years of research. One function is, the technical term is socially mediated positive, which I use the term, I want what I want when I want it, and that includes attention. So there are certain ways that you work when you're dealing with the SM plus, right, or the attention function, which includes stuff. So in that instance, there are a couple of rules. One is you can have attention. And you can have great, I'll give you more attention than you would have had, but never for that behavior. So the teacher, think about it, you know, a kid can demonstrate behavior, but they can't demand that cause responds with his attention. Or cause can alter the value of that attention and make the attention very limited with no eye contact. And what's the counterbalance to that? Well, the counterbalance to that is to let them know how to get positive attention. And the other one is when I put a demand in place, and this becomes typically in my experience, most of the time what happens when we have kids with severe problem behavior, there has not been consistency that when that demand is put in place, demand or request, whatever you want to call it, that the instructor follows through and that the learner understands that once I ask you to do something, I may alter the length of that task. I might alter the amount of energy or effort that you have to put into that task, but you're going to complete some aspect of that task, that request that I've made before we move on to the next thing. That to me is probably the most singularly most important thing to do next to this following rule. Catch kids doing things right quickly and reinforce it. Let them know. The best teachers, if you ever want to watch something really cool about how reinforcement works, go into a kindergarten class with little kids. Little kids, by their nature, tend to love coming into a very colorful, stimulatory environment known as kindergarten, the children's garden. And the best kindergarten teachers almost look like they're actors on a stage. They're all about catching kids doing things right very quickly. Now, fast forward to the algebra class in freshman year of high school. It's sterile. There's nothing going on. And, you know, occasionally you get back these papers with little red marks on them. Some say A's. Most of the time for me, they didn't say A. They said anything but A. But that the nature of the reinforcement is it's become so thin that that environment kind of suggests that I got to do something else to obtain some interaction, some attention. So again, back to the two components. As new teachers, you know, I was reading an article the other day that the reason that most new teachers, by that meaning teachers who've been in the field less than 5 years, 40 to 60% of them said the reason that they quit teaching is because of problem behavior.
No, that's really sad. I mean, especially for new teachers, you know, they don't know that much. They don't have world. I mean, I think they get like a couple of months experience as being a teacher. There's a training program and they have to before they become a certified teacher. So they don't have a lot of experience there. So, I mean, but there's only so much, like you said, teachers can do, so much a parent can do, whether a new parent or as their child grows up into the teen years and stuff. So they need to seek professional help. So what is a great resource for that? Or is there a course out there that can help people out, or, you know, that it's available at an expensive rate for people to who want to get into that and become the providers for the parents and institutions?
Sure, there is, Kaz. And one of them you're aware of, my wife actually has a course up called the Registered Behavior Technician. Her company, Verbal Behavior Institute, started this course years ago and has updated it continuously. That's it's a thorough course for the technical aspect of implementing ABA. And basically for the course to be completed, you get 40 hours of instruction. And at the end of it, you can make a decision. Hey, I'm just going to use this for my kid, or I'm going to use this and I'm going to try out a new professional path. And there I see you have some of the information up. The RBT was created, I think, predominantly to acknowledge there is a tremendous need in this country that is unmet, particularly around the increase in the children who are diagnosed with autism. I believe the official Center for Disease Control number tonight is about one out of every 36 children being born will be diagnosed with autism, which to me is stunning. I recall having a conversation with Congressman Chris Smith, who chairs the Congressional Autism Committee, and he and I both recalled back in 1980-81 that the literature said it was 1 in 10,000, 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 36. The larger challenge I see is that it's not a stable path. It's actually accelerating. And the method that you use to introduce teaching and instruction to children diagnosed with autism is very concrete. I don't like to say it's professional because parents live with children with special needs. educators have that child from 9 to 3, maybe 9 to 4. It's a much smaller block of time. But I do believe that parents can benefit tremendously about learning the behaviors that are necessary to shape behavior, as well as how to, you know, an important thing, but it's very difficult for parents to do, is to keep data. You know, if you're in the middle of a crisis, every crisis you think is the end of the world and it lasts forever. But if it turns out that last week you really kept a record of it and it was happening 5 times and this week is 3 times, and you begin to see a trend down where it looks like maybe next week it'll only be twice, and the week after that maybe only once or not at all. Data, I get it. It's not a natural thing for people to capture, but it's a very necessary thing for our own reinforcement that what we're doing is working or not, so that we can change path.
No, and I think it's important. We'll have a link to the course below again, whether you're listening to this on audio podcast or on video. It's very important. It's very inexpensive. And if you want to get into that and have a great career, but also help children and families anywhere in the world, pretty much. You know, the English, I think, is in English. The course is in English right now only, but, you know, you can ways to translate, and there's so many ways to do that now. And maybe you should look at doing it in different languages, perhaps, Terry. You know, I think that would be a good, you know, additional resource for other families of international.
Yeah, we had begun down the path of creating a Spanish language RBT course. And unfortunately, I think that the growth, the explosion of the people who have taken it to start off on a new career, forced the Behavior Analyst Board to basically say, look, we can really only deal with what we've got going here. Yeah. At one point, the BACB, Behavior Analyst Certification Board, was covering people around the world, Saudi Arabia, Japan, Europe. And they basically pulled back and said, look, you know, we have this growth. We've got a number of people here in the United States, and that's about what we can handle. So until we see the Behavior Analyst Certification Board say, yeah, we're ready for Spanish, unfortunately, I think to your point, you'll have to use some of the resources, most of which are free. We've actually looked into, could we link the course to a language interpreter? And it appears that things like Google Translate and other places are set up for that, and there is no cost. Yeah. So that probably is the best alternative at this point.
Yeah, just maybe sharing that information to potential people who might want to get it, who go on the site, that this is what they can do to get the information so it translated, whether words on a screen or whatever. And I mean, I've been able to see some of the videos in this 40-hour course, and it's very informative, plus has examples of procedures and with other people, children, and there's resources like Mr. Carbone, is that the
Doctor,
one?
Yeah, some, Dr.
Carbone started initially, who, you know, there's some really, one of the videos that I saw was very emotional in a sense, but the payoff is what that process when it started, and how a young lady went from a girl from basically being nonverbal, which means she can't speak, to where she answered questions, spoke, and was able to communicate with her parents and the professionals. So tell me a little bit more about that process, because of course teaches you different approaches also, not just you know, one way to do it, because kids are each different, and you know, you have to deal with that.
Yeah, and I know the video that you're speaking of. It's a little girl by the name of Brittany, and Vincent Carbone, to give credit, is probably one of the preeminent geniuses that I've encountered while I've been in the field. He worked with something called verbal behavior, which was a method to teach nonverbal adults originally, that were basically, with in the old days, they used to say mental retardation, nonverbal. But then he applied this work that was done by B.F. Skinner to children who were nonverbal. And there's a fairly significant percentage of children with autism who are nonverbal. Well, communication, Skinner's work basically demonstrated that communication is behavior. And in this video, I think it's still available online. You could go and look up Dr. Vincent Carbone. He's a doctorate of education. And this video shows a little girl, you know, and the heartbreaking thing here is, as a parent, you see this little girl whose parent had put her in a little cheerleading dress. I mean, the effort to present this little child as the impeccable little doll that she was to her mother and father is heartbreaking, because in the beginning, you see a little girl who behaves, I suspect, much like if you've ever seen The Miracle Worker about Helen Keller. She has no control. She's screaming, she's scratching, she's kicking, she's spitting. And the amazing thing is, within that 4-minute video, you see the transformation of this little child into a child that's verbally interacting, following instructional control. And you know, I found myself talking with you, Kaz, about, you know, what's the outcome of that? The work that was done probably took a few weeks, but that child will someday be 17 or 18 or 19 years old. Had there been no interaction and no help, she'd have been the adult Helen Keller, you know, and the destiny for that child and that family would have been very, very challenging.
No, I just think ABA is such an important part of everything because it supports effective treatment. It trains the professionals, you know, but they need to know how to pass the test and everything else and all the information prerequisites sort of in a sense. And the professionals, from what I can see, who are having these classes or on screen are very professional. And I think they're accessible. You can talk to them and follow questions if you want to. And just reach out to them. They're public, you know, information. So they're very energetic about what they're doing. They enjoy helping everybody and they're just super individuals. And, you know, and it's so great that yourself, your wife, and these professionals got together to offer something to families in need, you know, and professionals in need to help other professionals and parents and kids in the end. Because that, in the end, it's all about the children, you know, who you want to see that they're not wasting their lives. You know, they're actually important individuals that they can communicate better. And get some better life themselves. I mean, they can go out and you know, get jobs and stuff. So
absolutely,
it's a great path that it starts out with. And you know, the course is right there. That's the name of the course, and we'll link it down below. Anything else you want to add to that, Terry?
I think that you made a really nice point, Kaz, which is to extend the logic. You know, you're a parent. I'm a parent. If you have a child who has a disability that's unaddressed at the age of 6, I think to your point that it's very important that you get help, and that help could come from other parents. It could come from professional associations. In some places, special ed PTAs will help. But don't do nothing about it and assume it will get better, because typically it will not. Mm-hmm. And then unfortunately, you know, I've also been involved over the years as a behavior analyst and an educator where the police get involved with kids who have developed problem behavior. And, you know, God bless the police, because they don't know what to do about it. They've got one bag of tricks, and they also know that the bad guys are out there. And if they think they can, you know, I have a brother-in-law up in Westchester County, and he said to me, look, the bad guys know that if they can pretend to be disabled, they buy themselves maybe a second or two of time, during which time our lives become at risk. Right. So it's critically important, I believe, that the instructional control issue be very seriously addressed. And you also mentioned something that's a piece of this. There is something in the civil rights law called the right to effective treatment, which essentially for parents and for educators is important to understand that effective treatment has to be measurable by its nature. And ABA is really the only science of instruction that does that.
Well, I just, from everything I've seen and read in you know, discussions we've had, it's not a simple solution, you know, to provide these services. I mean, you know, some people think, oh, because some things people think you get like a tutor for a couple of months and it's over, but it takes years. It takes months. It takes years in some cases. And something we mentioned before is, you know, right now we're recording this in the middle of summer. So when school's over, the kids don't have that ongoing professional help that they get used to, that they love their teachers, their instructors, you know, they meet their friends, that kind of goes away. So that's a whole other element that doesn't exist. So, you know, this course can actually help you get people help that way beyond the school time period. If you happen to be working for a school or a company that provides those services at school time. So, you know, you can help year round. I mean, all the time, right?
Yeah, and you just reminded me, I mean, where the path can lead. I'm going to raise the name. My daughter-in-law's mother was a woman by the name of Carol Cochis, lived over here in Central Jersey, not too far from you. And she was a matron on a bus. And I'm a big guy. You know, I'm 6'6", and pushing that weight where human beings leave off and livestock begins. But at 16, I was still a big guy. Well, she happened to be on a bus about 3 years ago. and one of the individuals didn't have his belt buckle on, and she had to tell him to get his seatbelt on, and she took his iPad away from him. Well, he stood up, and she was a little petite thing, maybe 100 pounds, 5 foot nothing, and he grabbed her by the head, and he began to slam her head into the base of the seat. The driver got her to the hospital, but she died later that night from basically bleeding on the brain. So, you know, that was tremendously difficult for my granddaughter and my daughter-in-law. That's how bad this can get if behavior is not addressed early enough. Sad, but true story.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, you just see more of that type of behavior these days in you know, everywhere. I mean, and what doesn't help it is you see it different ways that could be shown. Before it was maybe television only, now it's social media. And it's like a lot of cases I've seen is people don't jump in to help. They pull their cameras out and start phones and start recording everything and post it. And look what I just saw. Look how, but this was crazy, you know, stuff, whatever. That's what you want to put in there. But that seems to be, you know, that's kind of drawing other people to say, hey, look, you know, I can be famous for a little while if I just go beat up on a kid or something. And it's, you know, it's sad in a way, you know, but this provides a way, another way to look at this, what might be causing it, how to deal with it. And so I guess the secret is to, well, the secret, but one of the things to deal the problem as it happens at a young age and repeat and revisit that. Don't just say, well, you know, my little daughter or son was behaving this way, but now they're good. I haven't heard anything bad, so everything is okay. I mean, you should still be checking on them. Everything okay? I heard some things were happening there. You didn't have any part of it. I mean, how would you approach that part of it?
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is also a key critical issue of some of the tragedies that I've seen are parents who are excellent parents, but they create what I call inadvertent reinforcement, meaning the child does something that would not otherwise be acceptable to anyone anywhere. And they make excuses by saying, oh, you know, Johnny's he's just a little different, you know, don't mind him. Well, again, unfortunately, you know, a kid who bites an adult at the age of 5 or 6 that's not been dealt with by the age of 16 or 18 now has a new title at the age of 18. It's called a criminal. And, you know, so and I do understand the parental desire to shield their children from I wouldn't say harm, but from consequences that are strict. But I think it's important also to recognize where that path leads, which is the point that I think you were making, Kaz.
Yeah, well, it's you just have to deal with it. That's, you know, some people don't want to deal with it, but you got to face the facts and help out, because as kids grow older, they could be more violent, like you say, and become violent adults. And, you know, it just carries on. So earlier you can get that, the better. That's why ABA is important, and why it's important to educators now and more than ever. I hope you'll learn a lot in this nice half-hour conversation with Terry Blackwell, who's a known and expert individual and a really cool guy to get to know. And, you know, you can reach out to him. Hopefully they won't, too many people won't reach out to you. Maybe you might have to sign an autograph after this. but, you know, so... The ABA course, info will be listed below if you want to check that out, or you want to actually purchase it and use it and make your life easier for yourself and for everybody else. Terry, final question, really big one. I know you've been on here twice before, but was the third time any better or nicer, or how was it for you being a guest on Casual Conversations?
I've learned all of the rules of appropriate eye contact, positioning, and field spacing. So it's gotten easier.
Thank you very much, Terry. And we'll talk to you soon once again. And links, like I said, to the other episodes are below. So check them out. And enjoy your day, everyone. And hope to see you or hear you next time you hear us on Casual Conversations.